What's up, freaks? It's your boy Marty here to introduce RIP 404. Error 404, content cannot be accessed. Just kidding. You're going to be able to access it, freaks. I sat down with Constantine Kissin, co-host of the Trigonometry podcast, author, and a great thinker. I had Constantine on because I really appreciate his efforts to get people out of the binary framework that they're often thrust into and in mainstream culture and political discussions. Really fascinating conversation. This was brought to you by our good friends at River. River is a Bitcoin company that has an exchange, has mining, has Lightning API that you can build on. I was often referring to it as a Bitcoin exchange. It certainly does have an exchange, but it's more than that. It's a Bitcoin company. If you're looking to acquire Bitcoin, you're looking at the banking crisis unfolding right now here in the United States, and you're thinking, there's a lot of counterparty risk there. Maybe I should get an asset that eliminates that counterparty risk. Bitcoin. Go to River. River.com/TFTC. They have the exchange. You can DCA. If you DCA into Bitcoin, you won't pay any fees on those buys. If you hold Bitcoin on River, they don't recommend it. They want you to send it to cold storage that you control. But if you do hold it on River, you can have the peace of mind knowing that your Bitcoin is 100% reserved on the exchange and is held in a multi-sig wallet. You can send and receive over Lightning to River. And again, if you want to build on Lightning, they have River Lightning Services, that their API. So go check it out. Maybe you have a Bitcoin exchange that you're using, but you should be using a Bitcoin company, River. You get the exchange plus a bunch of value-added services. River.com/TFTC. This RIP was also brought to you by our good friends down the hall, Unchained Capital. They're here to help you eliminate single points of failure in your custody model, help you eliminate the third-party custody risk that exists in the incumbent banking system that is taking a lot of people out right now. They have their Vault product, which is a 2 or 3 multi-sig wallet where you hold 2 keys. Unchained holds 1. As long as you have your 2 keys, you have permissionless access to your Bitcoin. It's a beautiful thing. If you're ever in a pinch and need Unchained to be the second in the 2 or 3 signature quorum, they're there for you. They have a consultation service that'll walk you through everything, get you hardware wallets, get you set up, get you comfortable. Go to unchained.com/consultation. Tell them that TFTC sent you. You'll get $50 off that service. They also just released an inheritance protocol. They have a lending desk, an IRA product, a financial company of the future. Unchained Capital. Go to unchained.com/consultation. Learn about everything they have going on there. This RIP was also brought to you by good friends at CrowdHealth. CrowdHealth is here to help you reimagine how you pay for your healthcare. Health insurance is notoriously opaque, impersonal, egregiously expensive. I was on Cobra paying an insane amount. I switched to CrowdHealth. It's not health insurance. It's a different way of doing healthcare, paying for your healthcare. It's significantly cheaper. I have my family of 4 on it. We're paying way less than we were on Cobra. So if you're an individual who unfortunately just got laid off in these tech sector layoffs and you're using Cobra right now, I know from personal experience how expensive it is. I would seriously consider CrowdHealth. It's a great community. You pay a monthly fee into a dedicated account that builds up. If you ever have a healthcare expense, you bring the bill to CrowdHealth. They negotiate it lower for you. You go to the doctor, say, hey, we can pay you in cash right away. Let's get a cheaper price. And the doctor likes that. They're like, hey, I'm getting paid cash right away. Sure. I'll lower the price. You pay the first $500 of that bill, and then the rest gets crowdfunded by the CrowdHealth community. They have a Bitcoin community where you'll pay your monthly fee. It'll build up in your dollar account, and then after a certain amount of months, you'll begin to stack Bitcoin along that dollar account as well. So you can speculative attack your future healthcare costs. Another thing to mention about CrowdHealth is it is a community of healthy individuals. You do have some metrics you have to hit to get into the community. And because of that, the overall BMI of CrowdHealth users is lower than the national average. And overall healthcare costs for the CrowdHealth community is lower than the average American health insurance plan. So go check it out. Joincrowdhealth.com/TFTC. Use that code. You're going to get $99 a month for the membership fee for the first 6 months. Joincrowdhealth.com/TFTC. Last but not least, this RIP was brought to you by our good friends at Bitcoin Talent Co. They're here to help you find a job or find talent. A recruiting firm built by Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners, so they understand the different companies in the space looking for talent and what they need, whether it's Lightning, a Lightning developer, or somebody who knows UX around Lightning, or somebody's working on multi-sig at the protocol layer. They know what they need to go out and find. And then on the talent side of things, If you're out there, you're in the tech sector, you're in the banking sector, but you're a Bitcoiner, you don't know how to get in, go to bitcointalent.co. Tell them the TFTC sent you. Yeah. If you're a company, hit them up. If you're talent looking to get into a company, hit them up. It's a beautiful thing. Enjoy this, Rip Freaks.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
What is up, freaks? It's your boy Marty here, sitting down with Constantine Kissin, who made a splash earlier this year with, I guess it wasn't a lecture, it was more of an oration, a monologue at Oxford, talking about woke culture in the context of climate change and why young individuals shouldn't fall prey to the mindset, the doomer mindset that the world's going to end, and should instead think differently. And that led me to your Substack, Constantine, where you're really talking about alternative ways to view the world. And that's really what I wanted to talk about. It seems like a lot of the conversation in the mainstream is these binary choices that we have or are perceived to have as a society. And I think you frame it as the current thing versus going against the current thing. But I really like your attempt to try to shake people out of that binary mindset and have us thinking about alternative views, alternative systems, alternative ways of doing things. I mean, that was a long preamble to the conversation, but I guess what personally for you really drove you to realize this binary frame that the mainstream is trying to force the world into and got you thinking about alternative systems?
I think I'm a bit of a disagreeable asshole. So if I can disagree with somebody, I usually will. And I think that's kind of how I end up in the middle of a lot of things. I kind of go, well, you guys are sort of making sense, but there's also quite a lot of BS in that. And you guys are sort of making sense, but there's quite a lot of BS in that. And so I often find that, you know, I tend not to go along with the crowd. I don't mind going along with the crowd when I think the crowd's right. And that is actually something that a lot of people have trouble now with as well, because they're like, well, I'm the sort of person that doesn't go along with crowds, so I can never go along with a crowd, even if, you know, they're taking me to a safe place as opposed to off the cliff. So yeah, I think that's more than anything where that comes from for me. I try to be very careful about going along with other people's ideas of what I should do, because I really learned from a young age that it was important to think for myself.
Yeah, same. I think that, I mean, not saying that I think exactly like you or think for myself in the way that you do, but that was one thing my mom beat into us growing up, be a leader, not a follower, like think differently, think about things from different perspectives. And I guess for you, like talking about like the context of the world, it's pretty chaotic in the world right now. Again, you have climate hysterics, you have woke culture permeating a lot of the Western hemisphere. And it seems like people are very confused right now, especially coming out of the last 3 years with COVID lockdowns and a restructuring of the economy and a lot of authoritarianism around the world. What are some of like the first principles that you anchor to when trying to view what's going on in the world and how you view it?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you bring up COVID and authoritarianism, because I was talking to someone else an hour ago about COVID. And to me, that really, I find that very scary, because this guy I was talking to, he was saying, well, look, you know, what happened was really undemocratic. And they introduced, in his country, in Australia, they had quarantine camps. And in the UK, we had mandatory vaccination and all of these things. And he was like, that was undemocratic. And I was saying to him, no, that it's worse, much worse than that. It wasn't undemocratic. It was illiberal, but it wasn't undemocratic. It was exactly what the majority of the people wanted. The majority of the people in the UK, I don't know what the polling would have been like in the US, but there was a huge percentage of people here in the UK who just, they, you know, they lost the plot. They got really scared. They panicked. They made the government panic. The media forced the government to panic. And there was a massive overreaction. And they had absolutely no problem with it. They had no problem with it. And so the scary thing to me isn't that we are sort of, you know, living in some kind of undemocratic world in which the evil elites are telling us what to think, which some people are persuaded by. I don't believe that at all. I think the problem is a lot of people are willing to give away far too much safety, far too much freedom, rather. A lot of people are willing to give away far too much freedom to get a promise of safety from a government that is therefore incentivized to keep promising them safety and is therefore incentivized to keep taking away their freedom.
That's the meme, govern me harder, daddy, is coming to mind.
Right, yeah, now. Exactly. And we live in societies, it turns out, you know, I mean, people have known this throughout the ages, but we, our generation and younger had the opportunity to forget about that. When the proverbial hits the fan, you know, people go revert to type, and it turns out quite a lot of people revert to authoritarianism mentally whenever things go bad.
Yeah, no, and it certainly happened here in the States too, especially in the beginning, early 2020. Yeah. People were, I think myself included, at least in the early days, like, all right, 2 weeks to flatten the curve. That sounds like a good idea. Let's just batten down the hatches.
I was there. I was right there. Absolutely. This is people are having a go at me now going, oh, you know, you're this guy who, you know, keeps talking about COVID authoritarianism. Well, but, you know, in the first few weeks, you were fine with it. Yeah, I was fine with it for 3 weeks because, we needed to find out what the hell was going on. But once you know what's going on, that's the point at which you've got to start acting rationally again. And that was my issue with it, you know. So I know it happened in America as well. The good thing about America is that you guys have different states. And so if you don't like the state's policies that you're in, you can pack up and move. In the UK, what are we going to do?
Yeah. I mean, I'm an example of that. I live in Texas now. I was living in New York. It was partly driven by, all right, I think Texas is going to respect my freedom's a bit better than the state of New York is right now. So let's get the family and get down there.
It was incredible. We went on a trip to America last year and we saw this with our own eyes because we went from the East Coast, New York, Washington, to Texas, and then to Nashville, and then to LA. And it was like being in different countries, man. Like when we were in Austin, I didn't see a person wearing a mask for the entire time that we were there. When we got to LA, literally everybody was wearing a mask at the airport, like everybody. And if you got a taxi, I can't remember what your system is. We have, we call it Uber here. In Austin or in a bunch of other places, no one cared if you were wearing a mask. This was last year. In LA, they were still making you wear a mask. You know, so it was like completely different countries. And my point is, it's great to be able to choose what you want. And if you are a govern me harder daddy kind of person, then you can go to a govern you harder state like California and have a great time. But if you want a bit more freedom, then you can do what you've done and move to a place that actually respects it.
Yeah, no, and I think that's a trend that's only going to get more prominent here in the United States, as states beginning to assert their autonomy from the federal government. In many ways, it happened with COVID. Like I mentioned, this is a Bitcoin podcast here in the United States. Bitcoin mining is a massive political talking point now, and you're seeing individual states say, hey, mining's cool here. Others saying, like New York, saying, we don't want Bitcoin mining here. And I think that's just going to keep extending into other parts of the social discussions that we have. Florida with the pulling the particular sex education materials out of the public schooling system. Something like that is happening in Texas as well. That's something that gives me great hope for the United States, especially in a world that seems a bit pessimistic right now, particularly when you think of the trends that are gaining prominence. Well, they were gaining prominence for a time, but I do think things like ESG and woke culture are beginning to erode a bit as people get fed up, because at the end of the day, like economic and social reality comes into play. And
well, right, but the economic and social and military reality is very difficult as well, right? So you've got maybe people taking life a bit more seriously, and they maybe don't have quite as much time for, you know, weird protests on college campuses or whatever when there's real stuff going on in the world. on the one hand. On the other hand, I think you're right. We're in a kind of pivotal time. I think the future of the next 50 years is going to be shaped in the next 10. You know what I mean? It's kind of like World War II. Like World War II finishes and that kind of sets the template for the next 60, 70 years. I think we're looking at something like that at the moment.
What are you looking at particularly in terms of areas where things are going to be seen?
Well, I mean, the geopolitical landscape is becoming completely reshaped, right, as we speak, both in Russia and in China and therefore around the world. Economically, I mean, the idea, modern monetary theory, summed up in a simple way, the idea that we can continue to borrow money from our grandchildren endlessly, it's sustainable for a while, but eventually that's going to end. And people, very clever people, keep telling me, you know, politicians and economists, and they've all got an explanation of how this makes perfect sense. And, you know, a country like Britain can run a national debt that it's greater than its GDP and can continue to pile more debt with a massive budget deficit. And everything's going to be fine. Everything's going to be absolutely fine. There's not going to be any problems. And they're all very clever, and they know more about economics than I do, and they know more about finance than I do, and that's all very, 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 very nice. But that's not how the real world works. There's no such thing as a free lunch. At some point, whatever is going on there, that's going to have to be addressed one way or another. And if we keep burying our head in the sand, I mean, the problem is just when that bubble gets burst, it's going to burst in the most spectacular way if we allow this to continue.
Well, it may be bursting as we speak, particularly here in the United States.
There's a reassuring thought.
I mean, what's going on now with this banking crisis that started probably a couple of weeks ago, but really accelerated towards the end of last week and continue
today. Banking is only one part of it, man. Sorry to interrupt, Marty, but banking is one part of it. Like a financial crisis and a coming to Jesus moment on the issue of debt, these are very different things, you know. And we've all been living way beyond our means for decades now, and we are refusing to recognize that, in my opinion, you know. And we basically, our response to 2008, when a financial crisis turned into a global recession, was to empty the medicine cupboard, right? We took all the medicine we had, interest rates, real interest rates were negative, emergency level interest rates for like a decade, just, you know, threw everything at it. Well, okay, cool. Now it's coming around again. What are you going to do?
Oh, they're just going to print obscene amounts of money. And that's what, I mean, what's going on in the United States now. I recorded a podcast about it earlier this morning with a gentleman named Parker Lewis, who's really been following the Fed policy and its effect on the banking sector for like 15 years now. And it is a bit intertwined in the sense that like the government has mandated that the banks have to hold a certain amount of treasuries. And as we're going through this crisis now, people may have said, oh, you can never see this coming. But if you look at the mechanics of it, like the Fed's going to jack up interest rates, which lowers the value of the collateral that you're forced to hold on your balance sheet. And then as you have to sell that out to service withdrawals, you have to mark down that as a loss. And it's created this cascading effect. But again, yeah, I completely agree. Like the Keynesian brain rot thought of debt is just money we owe ourselves completely disregards future generations. Like, no, debt is money that our children and grandchildren owe us or owe them.
We owe to them.
Yes.
We owe it to them. We're borrowing it from them without their consent. And what's more is it obviously affects, you know, we're like a problem gambler now. No, you know, there will come a point where people don't want to lend us money, you know, one way or another, or we're not prepared to lend it to ourselves, or people don't want to buy a currency because these things that we're doing, they're not consequence free. Otherwise, why wouldn't we endlessly print any amount of money? Like, why should I pay any tax ever again if we can just print money and it has no consequences? That's what they keep telling us. We can print an endless amount of money and everything's going to be fine. Right? 100% of GDP, no problem. 200%, whatever. Like, we can keep going, apparently. This is what they keep telling us. We can keep this going. why do I need to pay my taxes then? Why don't you just print my share of the national tax and spend it if there's no consequence to printing money?
Well, taxes are just the humiliation ritual part of it. They're gonna fuck you from
I can
both
tell
ways.
You're a Bitcoiner.
You're a bit skeptical of Bitcoin, is that correct? Or
I'm not skeptical of the technology and its potential for use. I'm very skeptical of the marketing around it.
Mm-hmm.
The moment a system of doing business becomes ideological, it should not be ideological. Like, you know, if a physicist, generally speaking, is not going to be ideological about their branch of physics, they want to know the truth as opposed to prove their point. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
And when I see so much ideology around, like it's almost like a whole worldview around Bitcoin and the way it's marketed by some people, you know, yet another hot girl in a crop top talking to the camera about, hey guys, you need to buy Bitcoin. I'm like, Jesus, get that thing away from me. You know, so that's what I'm skeptical about. As for the technology, I mean, people say it's a great way for people in poorer countries to do business in a volatile, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I spend a lot of time in poorer countries, places like Armenia and Ukraine until the war and stuff like that. Nobody there is really using Bitcoin to do transactions. And, you know, I'm not saying it's not possible. It is possible. And some people do, but it's an area that I always bookmark by saying at the beginning, I don't know anything about it. And at the end by saying, I really don't know anything about it, but people keep asking me. So I keep giving them some kind of answer.
Yeah, I think I caught you on Pop's podcast.
Yeah,
talking about it.
Yeah, and I did say to him repeatedly, A, I'm going to trigger you and your audience, and B, I don't know what I'm talking about.
I don't think you're going to trigger anybody by saying that, and I think that's a very fair assessment. Depending on who is explaining Bitcoin, it can come off a bit scammy.
Well, right. And this is one of the things I've been thinking a lot about outside of the concept of Bitcoin itself is like, because our experience of the world is so fragmented compared to how it was 20 years ago, right? 20 years ago, I mean, probably not the case in America, but in the UK, we had 5 TV channels, right? And most of the stuff you would see, you'd be watching together with like almost everybody else. Do you know what I mean? There'd be a popular program on at 7 p.m. and you'd watch that and everybody would watch that. And so when you have social media and the internet and the huge explosion in content, what we even mean by a word is different. Like what I mean by Bitcoin is going to be completely different to what you mean by Bitcoin, because our experience, we just have a completely different window into that room from a different angle. And you and I are seeing very different things. I might be seeing some fluff in a corner where you are seeing a big sofa or a big couch in the middle, right? And so our perspective of it is really shaped by the fact that our experience of the world is so fragmented now that we probably don't have a common one, you know? So to me, Bitcoin is the hot girl on Twitter, you know, selling Bitcoin. To you, it's a system of exchange or a medium of exchange or whatever else that is going to revolutionize the world. And so that's why I don't really have a strong opinion on it, because it's not an area that I've studied that well.
Yeah. I think the anchoring lens that really gets people in this fragmented world on the same page is just actually like interacting with it, spinning up a wallet, sending Bitcoin, holding it. Because when you do that and you recognize that you have 12 or 24 words that represent your wealth and you use those words to make your Bitcoin appear in another wallet, that's like an aha moment. And that experience is uniform across the world instead of having a fragmented sort of explanation of Bitcoin from many different mediums, from many different people. But yeah, I mean, considering what's going on now in the banking crisis, people talk about number go up, Bitcoin's going to be millions of dollars. But what is really important is just having access to your money, whether it goes up or down, which people woke up Friday morning with tens of millions of dollars in this bank they thought was solvent and didn't have access to it. Where if you have Bitcoin and you have it in your wallet and you have the the private key backed up. Like, nobody can stop you from accessing.
Yeah, sure. But I have Bitcoin. I have Bitcoin, and I'm, you know, waiting for it to explode, because I already made the mistake once. I bought it when it was, I think I bought half a Bitcoin for $400, and then I bought another half of Bitcoin for $500. And then a few years later, when it had gone up to, I don't know, maybe my whole Bitcoin was worth about $2,000 or something like that. It was those sort of numbers. I was like, oh, wow, this is like doubled in value. Okay, let's sell it. And then now it's, well, then it was worth whatever it was worth. And now, anyway, my point is, we have some Bitcoin on my YouTube channel that people paid us for advertising with, that's been sitting in a Bitcoin wallet. And it was worth $2,000 a year ago. Now it's worth $800. So, you know, this idea that Bitcoin is this brilliant store of value, it has not been my experience, you know, necessarily.
No, it's about, you get the whole spiel, it's time in the market, not timing the market and all that. And
But if you actually need the money that you've got in there, right? Like, you're potentially going to, you know, let's say I'm saving up to buy a house, which is what I'm doing, right? I'm not going to save it up in Bitcoin for that reason.
Yeah. I can see it. It's I had that experience as well. We do a lot of ad deals in Bitcoin here. took in a lot of ad money at the end of 2021 when the price was around 50K.
Right.
And unless you were selling that right away or locking in half of that, I have watched it depreciate in value pretty significantly. Yeah. But when you put it in the context of the alternative, which is the system that we're describing, that is just printing money, putting us further and further into debt. It is a nice asset that brings peace of mind in the long term, at least. But yeah, agree. There's going to be a shit ton of price volatility year in and year out until people wake up and understand that the incumbent system's completely messed up.
Hmm.
Yeah. But I mean, I feel like it's all tangential too. Like, we have these problems in the banking sector with the national debt here in the United States and the UK. And then you have like the social fray as well, and people are getting driven to both sides of the spectrum. And that's one thing I worry about, why I really like the framing that you put forth, which is like current thing versus opposing the current thing. It's like figuring out the other thing in the middle where people can meet and put their efforts behind to actually affect change in the world. Because what I worry about is people get driven to both sides of the spectrum, and you have a very aggressive reaction from one side against the other, and you get Weimar Germany like situations, World War II like situations. Yeah, and it seems like,
well, we're hopefully too fat and too comfortable now to have an actual that, you know, communists versus fascists battling out in the streets. Although, you know, you do see some things people could point to, particularly in America, in terms of, you know, far left groups and far right groups getting together and fighting and whatever. But I'd hope that remains a fringe thing. But you're right. I mean, the main reason I think to be concerned about that polarization is it prevents us from having a cohesive, uniting vision of who we are. And that makes us very vulnerable to people who would quite like to throw the West off its pedestal. You know, this is, a lot of people don't understand this about the conflict in Ukraine. It's really fundamentally about the attempt to reshape geopolitics. And I've translated many of Putin's speeches on my Substack and summarized them in a way that's easier to read for Western people. And this, he talks about it in every speech. He wants America out of Eastern Europe. He wants America to stop being the single dominant geopolitical force in the world. He wants what he calls a multipolar world. If we continue to, you know, sit around and argue about what woman is, we're kind of exposing ourselves to, you know, we're not using our time as well as we could be in advancing our civilizational mission, which is to make sure that our people thrive in the world, that we are strong, that we are capable, that we are able to defend our values you know, all of those things. If we take AI off the ball, we're opening the door to other people.
Yeah, I mean, Putin explicitly leans into that too. Like, look over there. They're confused about gender ideology.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And he's mainly doing that, in my opinion, to he's doing two things. He's pandering to people in the West who are frustrated at those things, as I am, by the way, and as I'm sure you are, you know, the gender ideology being the extreme versions of gender ideology being pushed in the way that they're being pushed. And so he's trying to win allies over in the West by going, look at this thing that you don't like. I don't like it either. And he's pandering to people in Russia who want to think of the West as this like LGBTQI, whatever, which obviously they hate. You know, he's trying to sort of present the West as decadent, which to some extent I'd agree with it has been, to people who just, you know, they, there's this word for Europe in Russian that some of these Putin fanboys like to throw out, which is Gayropa. Like Europe, Europa is the Russian word for Europe, Gayropa. You understand?
Yeah.
So like it fits neatly into the narratives of both of those groups, and he's trying to play to them both at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. And sort of engender support from Westerners, like, hey, this stuff's crazy. Putin even recognizes it. Like, is he a stronger leader? Undermining. Yeah. I mean, well, that's the other thing too, is particularly in the United States, I'm sure you feel this way in the UK too, but like just looking at the political class and the quote unquote leaders we have representing us on the geopolitical stage as a millennial, looking at these people who can't even put together coherent sentences anymore, and have no connection with reality or, the underpinning sort of angst that exists between millennials and Gen Zs. It's really disheartening. It's I look at Biden, I look at across the spectrum, whether it's Biden on the left or somebody like Mitch McConnell on the right and others. I'm like, I don't think you guys align with me at all. It is really discomforting to me to think that you represent me on the global stage.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. And, you know, one of the things increasingly I'm starting to realize, I just turned 40 a few months ago. And like we have people working on trigonometry who are like 17. And I've kind of up until this point sort of thought of myself as a young person. And then you meet people and talk to people who are like 17, 18, 20, and you go, whoa, this is like a whole other generation. Like they've got their own challenges. Think about things differently to us, approach things in a different way. So imagine someone like Joe Biden, like we are two generations away from him, right? So there's no way he understands the problems of Gen Z or the problems of millennials or whatever. And look, it was ever thus, of course. It was ever thus. But yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah. And I guess that's the thing I wonder about moving forward is how does that exchange of power or exchange of influence happen? How do we get the power out of the hands of the boomers? And I hate to like put people in like classes and say like it's their problem, but it seems like they're living in a mindset.
Listen, man, we're going to be boomers someday, so you watch your mouth.
I know, exactly. But it seems, and there's good boomers out there. I've met a lot of them, but the ones in power seem to severely underestimate the potential that like the millennials and Gen Zs, many people, many individuals within those demographics have to affect change. It seems like they're just putting their foot on the brake to not let it happen.
But I also think it's a large extent, you know, the millennials' fault as well. You know, mm-hmm. We're getting to the age now, certainly I feel I am, like we should be influencing the way things are, and not enough of us are, because not enough of us, you know, have built things and created things and achieved things that we should have been. I think that's also true. You know, too many millennials spend their time moping about going, oh, my life is so hard. Well, sure. Yeah, it's hard. Yeah. But I don't think it's as hard as my 96-year-old grandmother in Ukraine who lived through the Nazi occupation and the Holodomor and the gulags and Stalin's purges and the collapse of the Soviet Union and now another invasion by Vladimir Putin. Don't think our lives were as hard as that, right? So maybe there's an opportunity for us to take some responsibility and to go, okay, what are we going to do now? You know, and I think for millennials, you know, that's part of, you know, we're kind of I'm just about a millennial, but there is a, you know, I feel like a generation that hasn't fulfilled its potential potentially, you know.
Agreed. I think a lot of millennials are complacent and distracted. I mean, going back to the preamble at the beginning of this conversation about climate change and LARPing about that particular subject has become a lot of people's personalities where they don't understand reality and the fact that you can virtue signal and say, oh, I care about the climate, but that has consequences at the end of the day. I mean, particularly in the energy sector, we've really driven the narrative that we need to transform our energy sector into this renewable safe haven, but that's proving to actually deteriorate the quality and the stability of our energy systems.
Surprise!
Yeah.
Well, the Biden approved some kind of oil drilling thing. I haven't had a chance to read up on it properly, but there was some kind of oil drilling approved today in America. So reality is coming home.
Yeah, up in Alaska. I believe they're finally going to let them drill.
Yeah,
up in that area of the country. But no, when you look at Europe and Trump tried to warn Germany, like, hey, you're becoming heavily dependent on Vladimir Putin's natural gas. Like, you should try to restructure your energy sector so you don't become beholden to him. They laughed at him. And less than 3 years later, that problem became very apparent to all of Europe.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so what do you think is like the most effective way to break out of that binary thinking and start pushing people towards these alternative ways of viewing the world and alternative solutions, or just engendering a feeling of urgency and action in people?
Well, I don't know that it is the feeling of urgency that I want to encourage in people. It's actually at this moment in time, I think everybody just needs to be encouraged to have a feeling of self-restraint rather than urgency. When people feel that something is urgent, they start running around doing crazy shit. We talked about COVID. I mean, people had a lot of senses of urgency about that. No, mm-hmm. Didn't do us any good. What I think people need to do is slow down and look around and go, is screaming and shouting about things changing the world? Is it? Look around. Since 2015, 2016, Brexit, Trump, you know, you take you through a whole litany of things. What we've done is we've massively increased the amount of hostility that both sides have towards each other. Have the results been what you wanted? Right? Yeah. Because I don't think they have. They haven't been what I wanted. And so do we carry on doing this? Do we carry on getting angry at each other and going, no, they're really the evil ones? Or do we try and have a more sensible conversation? And the dynamic of the cultural conversation is massively in favor of anger and hate. And I'm not pretending that single-handedly by talking in a more constructive way on this podcast, we're going to change that. But I'm just trying to model that and be that myself and have conversations with people from that place. It's increasingly why I use Twitter less and less, because like the version of me that comes out on Twitter, because of the way Twitter changes your brain, is not the version of me that I would like to be most of the time. You know, I open Twitter, I'm very tempted to troll someone, take a dump on them, point out how they mess something up, how stupid they are, blah, 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 blah. And I don't know that that's the best way to achieve the things I want to achieve. So I'm just trying to be more constructive and think about, you know, what are the things that people can unite around? What are the things that can bring people together? That's why, you know, I started out as a stand-up comedian who became very alarmed at all this woke stuff that was going on in comedy, because comedy being like a cultural industry, that all the cultural trends get there first. So it was like before society got there almost. And I was like, whoa, what's happened here? And so I became known as someone who was very against woke culture, which I am. But I don't know that the way to oppose that is the increasingly sort of I'm a victim now, anti-woke movement. You know, I've been oppressed now. The saying that libs are transing the kids or whatever it is. Like, you know, there's libs running around your neighborhood just like grabbing kids off the street and taking them off to a trans reassignment clinic. I don't think that's happening either. You know what I mean? So there's this a lot of this building up of victimhood on both sides. Even, you know, and I say that as someone who thinks, you know, we alluded to the trans thing briefly, like that's a problem. The teaching of sexualized material to children in schools is a problem and does need dealing with. But my view is the way that that issue gets dealt with is by convincing the majority of people that this is something is happening and that they should care about it, because that's all that it really takes. Like we had a case here in the UK where a transgender rapist, or rather a rapist who claimed they were transgender after they were caught, claimed to be a woman and ended up in a woman's prison, right? And when the public found out about this, they were like, whoa, we don't support this. And actually, the part of the UK that happened in was Scotland. The leader of Scotland resigned soon afterwards. I'm not saying it was entirely down to that, but that was part of it, right? So you have to convince the overwhelming majority of people who are pretty much on this side of the conversation anyway, because they haven't been indoctrinated and all this crazy stuff. They're just normal people who've got kids and jobs and lives to live, and they're not really into the culture war, you know. We just got to show them, A, that it's happening, and B, persuade them that they should basically take action or speak up about it or whatever in a calm way in order to change these things, right? Instead of just building anger and resentment. And it's so funny to me, whenever I make this critique of the anti-woke, you know, people are always like, we must fight fire with fire. And I'm like, that generally speaking isn't how you fight fire. Like the fire brigade do not turn up to your house with a bucket of gasoline and some matches. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, that's not how you do it. Even the metaphor doesn't work. So I just think the solution to all of this is in the media space, which is what we are, the new media, right? Is to have conversations in a way that's gonna bring people back from the brink, you know, that's gonna not make them feel, you know, there are YouTubers who get millions of views, and they show up on my thing, and it's every day it's like World War III, or like Biden about to destroy America, or, you know, the MAGA is, you know, like all that stuff from left and right. And I've, you know, I don't live in America, but it doesn't seem to be to me on the brink of imminent collapse. I'm not saying you guys don't have problems, but it seems to me like you're going to be okay for the next couple of weeks. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, we shouldn't exaggerate too much the extent to which these cultural problems are as dangerous as we think. Now, long term, I absolutely think the trend of wokeness is a problem, and if allowed to run unchecked, it will do huge damage to the West, which to me is very important, and I wrote a whole book about it. But the way to prevent that from happening is to check it calmly and gently. Firmly, but gently at the same time, right? Yeah, and to start to talk about sensibly about what the potential positive solutions might be. We've got to have a positive vision of the future. And I haven't given you any parts of that, because that's a conversation that we still need to have as a society. One of the problems we've had is that over the last 10 to 15 years, like all the things that you used to be able to say are objectively good things, even though not everybody would be expected to participate in them, like having family and having children, right? That used to be a thing that we all understood as like, it's a good thing to have. Not everybody has to have it. It's okay. Mm-hmm. People shouldn't be forced to have a family. Some people are gay and they might not want to adopt kids or whatever, right? Some people just might not want to have kids, even if they're straight. Some people may not want to be in a relationship. That's all fine. But generally speaking, for most people, having a family is good, right? That's something that we used to be able to say. Well, now if you say that, you're automatically like a conservative because you think most people are going to want to have children. Well, guess what? They are going to want to have children, right? And they should, and it's good if they do. It's okay, and it's good if someone doesn't, if that's the right decision for them. But that's something that I actually think we should be able to say. And lots of other things like that where we've become so afraid of the marginal case that we refuse to say the bigger picture thing, which is, you know, people living in healthy relationships is good. Men and women need each other. Having kids and family is going to be a good thing for most people, and so on and so forth. There's a whole bunch of these things that we could talk about that used to be possible to say. Now they almost have to be won back or reframed or rephrased for people to go, oh, that's a great new idea. Let people have family. It's not a new idea, but that's the sort of thing I'm talking about.
Yeah, being physically fit, living a healthy lifestyle.
Right.
Yeah. Fundamental.
Being responsible financially with your money and the government being responsible with its money. Like, these are all pretty uncontroversial things until about 2 minutes ago.
Yeah. No, and then getting back to like Twitter and the mediums through which people dissect this information, like they're very high leverage tools for a very small subsect of the population. So I think that's another thing that really disrupts the conversation that people have globally, is you have like a small minority of people leveraging this technology that makes their voice seem louder than it actually is, or makes it seem like there's more people who agree with them on this.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, I think that's one thing people are definitely becoming more attuned to. And that's why alternative media, like your show, this show, others are beginning to proliferate. But you're seeing it both ends, like the vitriol and the those against the current thing and those for the current thing are existing in alternative media platforms as well. But like bringing it back to comedy, that was actually one thing that really became apparent to me during the COVID lockdowns. And there was that series of YouTube videos about mass psychosis that was going around, and basically the first described the problem and applied it to what was happening in 2020 and 2021. And then the second was like, all right, what is the solution for getting out of this? And comedy is actually one of the solutions, like bringing a bit of levity to the situation and lightly making fun of those in power, pushing you down these authoritarian paths. And I think everybody connects with comedy, and making things funny can make a subject approachable, and then give somebody a perspective where they're willing to change their mind and say, oh, maybe this is a little bit crazy.
It's so funny you say that, man, because during the pandemic, our show really exploded. And that's because 3 or 4 nights a week at the time, we do a show. So our channel is an interview channel. We do interviews with interesting people, but also myself and my co-host Francis, 4 nights a week then, 3 nights a week now, we do a show called Trigonometry Raw. And that is basically me and him joking about whatever's going on, the most outrageous jokes. We do all the crazy accents from around the world. Like, we get people from India sending us rupees to get us to do their accent. People from the Middle East, Italy, America, obviously all parts, and Canada, Brazil, like everywhere. And we do terrible accents and make jokes and take the piss, as we say. And we did that throughout the pandemic. And the most common thing people say to us if they come up to us in the street is, you got me through the pandemic. Because people needed that relief. People needed to be able to laugh at the terrible things that were happening, both in terms of the disease and the pandemic and the fact that people were dying and all the rest of it, but also the massive overreaction that we saw from governments in the West as well. I'm really pleased that we were 2 people out of, I'm sure there were many people doing this, but it felt like it still wasn't enough, mocking and criticizing the people who were doing it.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, I think what it does is it highlights that the people making these decisions are fallible human beings as well. People like to hold them on this pedestal and think of them as omniscient beings that can make the right decisions on our behalf. But once you use a bit of comedy to highlight some of the missteps they've taken and some of the contradictions of logic that exist with their decisions, you're really like, oh, maybe these people are just humans too. And if that's the case, maybe us individuals can affect change as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So what's on the top of your mind right now in terms of what's going on in the world? Obviously, woke culture is big, but I saw you had a discussion with Piers Morgan about the migrant situation in the UK. Obviously, Rishi Sunak has taken up the prime minister role there, unelected way. What are your thoughts on, like, Rishi sort of being just planted as the prime minister of UK?
Well, it's the system that we have. We have a parliamentary system, so we don't elect prime ministers in the way that you elect presidents. We elect the party, and then they have their own process for how they choose the leader. So, you know, that's a regular thing. It's happened to both sides. The last time there was a left-wing government, a Labour government, it was Tony Blair, and then he handed over to Gordon Brown, and there was no election. And the moment there was an election, he lost. So that's pretty standard for our country. I'm not a huge fan of Rishi Sunak, but, you know, in terms of what's top of my mind, I mean, there's so many things. I think I'm following the war in Ukraine very closely because, I just like I said, I think at the beginning we're in a bit of a pivotal time that is going to set the direction of travel for the next 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And I think that's kind of going to, by the end of this decade, we're going to know the direction of travel, or at least we will be on the direction of travel. Whether we know it or not will be a different thing. So that's kind of what I'm looking at, is how is that all going to end? Because that's the one big unanswered question for me in the world right now. On woke culture, I feel like we're starting to make progress, actually. I think two things are happening. Number one, many things are happening, but one of them is some people are getting tired of all this woke crap being shoved down their throat as they increasingly encounter it. The second thing is people are becoming more aware of it going on because it's infiltrating their workplaces and their colleges and their schools, their kids' schools, etc. The third thing is Gen Z are probably, the women not so much, but the young men, the Gen Z men, they're not woke at all, man.
No, noticed
they're not
this
woke
well.
At all. Yeah. So the girls, you know, girls are girls and they will go along with be nice and compassionate and kind and whatever for a while. But, you know, the young men are not woke. So there's a rebellion brewing against all of that, which is natural. It's what happens. It happens in comedy and music and everything. Everything goes in cycles. You go this way, then you go that way. So I feel like we're making decent progress. Doesn't mean we've won or, you know, this isn't a problem anymore. I think it still is. But I think we're making good progress on that, or at least in slowing down that. So the war in Ukraine for me is the big unanswered question. And of course, you know, with what we've seen this week, is this banking crisis going to be huge? I don't know personally. I don't have an opinion on that. But more broadly, as we've already talked about, I think we are sitting on a time bomb economically. And when that goes off, we'll have to see what happens as well. So those two things, I think.
Yeah, it seems like the banking crisis is serious to the point where the Fed is going to have to step in and print a bunch of money. They arguably did
really?
That yesterday. Yeah.
Okay.
You can make the argument the quantitative easing 5 started yesterday.
Okay.
And people are beginning to say that there's no way they raise rates next month. So it seems like that Fed pivot that everybody's been talking about is probably here. Because again, the setup of the capital requirements, it's forcing people to sell these treasuries, which is obviously driving their price down, which is making everybody's capital requirements below what they're supposed to be. So the Fed has to step in there. But I do want to talk about Ukraine too, because as an American, that's been a big headline here in the United States, particularly over the last year, as taxpayers have been sending over tens of billions of dollars, well over $100 billion now, month in and month out. And we're asking, like, what is the value of these dollars? How are they being spent? What are we getting in return? And there's obviously differing views amongst individual Americans. I tend to view this as a proxy war. I would rather not be engaged in it or supporting it, and would like both parties to come to the table to have some sort of talks, but it doesn't seem like our political class is really going to try to do that. They seem pretty keen on supporting the war the best they can.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of framing as supporting the war, because I don't think that's what they're supporting. This is, I'm afraid, one of those where I go along, or some people think I go along with the crowd. Mm-hmm. I don't. I just happen to know about this part of the world from a personal perspective. And so I have a different view on what's going on to most people. It's not for me ever to tell American taxpayers what they should be spending their money on. But I would say that the American taxpayers get an exceptionally good deal for their money right now. Okay. Exceptionally good deal. And that is because the United States is degrading the military of its primary strategic adversary without a single American life lost, and at a cost of a fraction of your defense budget, the entire purpose of which is to deter Russia and China. So you're getting a very good deal, in my opinion. And by the way, you know, you can call it a proxy war, but the reality is that the Ukrainians are in the process of attempting to achieve sovereignty for their country. And that to me is a very American thing to support. I mean, if you think about the origins of your country, this is kind of like the Ukrainian 1776 moment. And in the same way that for America to become independent and needed help from the French, I know you guys don't like to talk about it, but I'm afraid you did, right? You know, the reality is that, you know, all sorts of revolutions and independence movements in the past have relied on foreign assistance. So from my perspective, the most important thing is, what do the Ukrainians want? Like if America, you know, I was debating somebody the other day on this, and he was like, well, if Ukrainians stop fighting, the Americans would keep the war going. And I'm like, what? Like how? The Americans aren't over there fighting. It's the Ukrainians who are going, we want our country. We want to defend our country. Please help us if you want to. Right. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, you know, I know that there are many people who think along your lines in America. And it's a point of view I completely respect, because, you know, as a taxpayer, you're allowed to say, I want my money to be spent well. Like that's totally reasonable. But, you know, from my perspective, it's strategically a very sound thing for the West to be doing, because if you look at the ideology that motivates Putin, it's very clear that his sense is that America should not be present on the Eurasian continent. Like America, he wants America out of Europe entirely. He talked in his last speech about how he wants to, the United States is evil and wrong because it's undoing the post-World War II geopolitical order. Well, what does that mean? The post-World War II geopolitical order is Yalta, where the great powers basically decide that the Soviet Union, because of its contribution to winning World War II, gets to dominate and subjugate the entirety of Eastern and Central Europe up to and including East Germany, right? So if you want to let Putin restore that order, that's what you'd like to do. That's why, you know, you talked about Germany exposing itself to Russian blackmail because of energy. Why do you think Putin wants to? Why do you think Gerhard Schroeder, former chancellor of Germany, is on the board of some gigantic Russian oil company? There's even a word for this: Schroederization. It's the infiltration of a country's elites by a foreign power who wants to subvert them for their own ends. Like Putin has spent the last 20 years consolidating power within Russia and attempting to rebuild not the Soviet Union, but the Russian Empire, right? That's why he hates Lenin, because he gave away portions of the Russian Empire in order to achieve peace and in the Brest-Litovsk Treaty in 1917. So, or 1918, wherever it was. And so to me, while I understand that $100 billion is a lot of money, and I'm sure it sounds like a lot of money to the American taxpayer, I think from an American, purely an American point of view, forget Ukraine, forget morality, forget all of that, it's a very sound investment. And then you add to that the fact that you're, you know, the moral case to me is very strong, which is this is a country that wants to have its independence from Russia, and Russia won't let it be independent because it perceives this as, you know, Russian land, basically. So that's why we are where we are. And look, in addition to the financial side of it, you know, there's no doubt that having this conflict going on increases the risk of some kind of road to nuclear escalation. Now, do I think we have a serious risk of nuclear escalation now? No, I don't. I don't. But the fact is it's above zero. It's always above zero, but now it's above zero plus. So that's a factor. And that's why, you know, people should be very careful and very sensible. And, you know, idiots like Lindsey Graham running around going, you know, send in the second airborne or whatever. Yeah. Like, you know, these people are insane. But actually, the West has been pretty smart, in my opinion, about the way it's handled it. I know a lot of people are saying now in hindsight, you know, we should have given them the tanks from the beginning. We shouldn't give them the APCs from the beginning. Well, nobody, it's kind of like COVID. In the first 3 weeks, nobody knew what the hell was going on. And a lot of people were rightly concerned. It's like, you know, what if Putin's just gone a bit mad? And, you know, you give them some tanks and then he's like nukes Ukraine. We've seen over time with a careful strategy of giving them a bit of this, giving them a bit of that, giving them a bit of this, and you never really pushed hard across a line in some kind of major way that would give him a reason to escalate, you know. It's been very smart from the West, in my opinion. So, that's kind of my take on Ukraine. I understand that a lot of people feel differently, but, you know, it's an issue which I feel quite strongly about, particularly because people spread a lot of, like, an awful lot of lies about Ukraine. You know, this idea that Ukraine is full of Nazis, or, you know, Zelensky is some kind of Jewish Nazi, or all of this Nazi crap. Like, every country in Eastern Europe, I say this as someone who's Jewish, by the way, every country in Eastern Europe has a small fringe of anti-Semites on the far right. There's probably about as many Nazis in the American military as there are in the Ukrainian one. You know, every army in the world has some people who are minded in that way. And it's been frustrating for me to have to talk about all this stuff. You know, people go, oh, America's got biolabs in Ukraine. Yeah, do you know who built them? The Soviet Union. And the reason that America came in the 90s is they were like, this small country has biological labs, these biolabs. We best have someone responsible looking after them. It's the same reason that Ukraine was forced by America, Britain, Russia to give away its nuclear weapons back to Russia, because you don't want small countries having these sort of facilities that are not under control. You see what I'm saying? Again, by the way, that treaty in 1994, those countries, America, Russia, and Britain, guaranteed Ukraine's independence.
Yeah, it's because Ukraine... The Minsk Agreement, correct?
No. The Minsk Agreement was in 2014. That was called the Budapest Memorandum.
Oh, the Budapest Memorandum.
Yeah. The Minsk Agreement was in 2014 after what happened then. So it's a complicated issue, but I think I've given you my take on it.
No, and it's a very interesting take and a fresh perspective on this subject, on this show particularly. It's been a lot of people talking proxy war. And I think another thing that really makes Americans, and I'll just speak for myself, particularly apprehensive about getting involved in this war is just my whole life, whether it be the war in Iraq, Afghanistan, it always seems like the U.S. government and the intelligence apparatus have these ulterior motives where, again, I totally feel for the plight of the Ukrainian citizens and the Ukrainian people. When I see the U.S. government and CIA getting involved, I'm like, these motherfuckers have some ulterior motive. That
Well, I hear you, man, and I opposed the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq, and by the way, I oppose them for exactly the same reason that I oppose Putin's invasion of Ukraine. That this is kind of where I think people sometimes get a bit, you know, people go in a weird direction for me, because if you oppose the war in Iraq, you've got to oppose the invasion of Ukraine by Vladimir Putin. Like, what America did to Iraq is exactly what Putin is doing to Ukraine. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so I understand people's concerns about, you know, all my life I've just seen conflicts, but this is different. This isn't your country going and invading another country. This is your country giving military support to a country that's been invaded. That's the difference here. Do you see what I mean? And look, as I said to you about the French helping you guys during the American War of Independence, foreign powers will always get involved in these conflicts. That's just how it works. And so the fact that America is helping, I can see why that would trouble some people, but it's inevitable. I mean, you think the people who started this conflict in 2014 in Eastern Europe, you think they were actual Ukrainians who actually cared about rejoining the brilliant Russian state? No, it was a small fringe funded by Russia. in order to create the agitation and the separatist movement that, that they saw in the east of Ukraine in 2014. These people would never have done anything if they didn't know for 100% that they have Russia's support. So in that sense, you could call it a proxy war from both sides. Both sides are funding the people that they like in this conflict. That's what it is, man. I mean, yeah. The Ukrainians want to fight. They want to defend their country. And for me, what matters is what they want.
Yeah. Due to Bitcoin being global, having built out a strong network around the world of people in the industry that I know quite well, I have a few friends in the Baltics and Latvia, and they very much align with what you're saying. Shout out to Maddie Mazinkius over there.
Well, everybody in that part of the world is aligned with what I'm saying to a large extent, and that's because like they know that
they've lived through it.
They get it. And you could think of a country like Latvia. I mean, people, I was talking to my good friend Eric Weinstein the other day, and he's just been on Joe Rogan, and he was saying, well, you know, we let Latvia and Estonia join, and that was the start of it, and that's really, well, and his argument is, well, it's because these countries, you know, they were part of the Soviet Union, and Putin could never let that happen. How did these countries become part of the Soviet Union? This is the bit that they don't teach you in history for some reason, right? Neither in Russia nor in America. Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania were taken over by the Soviet Union in agreement with Nazi Germany in 1939. They split Eastern Europe, and actually people go, well, Germany started World War II. That's not what happened. That's not what happened. Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union invaded Poland at the same time, and they split all of Eastern Europe between them. And so the area that we now call Western Ukraine was actually Eastern Poland at one point. And the Soviets took it from the Poles, slaughtered thousands of their people at exactly the same time as Germany. And they did the same thing in Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. They came in, they took out anyone who opposed them, killed off the local elites, and replaced them with their own puppets. Right. So it's not like these are historically Russian lands exactly. These are just countries that the Soviet Union came and took over, killed the people who opposed it, and oppressed it by force. And so the Latvians, the Estonians, Lithuanians, they know what happens when Russia gets strong and when Russia has a leader who's managed to consolidate power. It's always going to look westwards. And that's why, you know, as generous as your country has been, and it has been very generous, in percentage terms, do you know which countries are the countries that are providing the most aid, in percentage terms of their GDP, I mean, that are providing the greatest aid to Ukraine? Well, it's Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, Norway, Finland, Sweden, and Poland. You know what these countries have in common? A border with Russia. What do you think they know that we don't?
Yeah, no, it's... Yes, I agree. I think Matthew Mazinkius, who lives in Riga, in Latvia, I think this is exactly how you would describe it. And I was actually over in Riga late last year talking to a lot of people from Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, and yeah, there seems to be like a band of Baltic brothers getting together and saying, like, we're not letting this happen again. Then, yeah, again, bring it back to the Americans. Like, for me, it's like, God, it's so far away. I don't want Russia to get strong. I hate all these politicians. And it's just like, fuck, are we just throwing gas on the fire?
Yeah, no, I understand. And when there's not a lot of trust in the political leaders and the political system, as there is not, then people are bound to think in that way. And look, obviously, just like the Russian intelligence services, the CIA gets up to a lot of shit. Everybody does, right? So I just think this is very different to the other conflicts that you mentioned earlier. And I think people sometimes forget that. And like I said, I understand, you know, why would we want to risk any sort of even raising the risk of nuclear war by even 0.1% for a fight somewhere where I've never been, far, far away on the other side of the world? I understand that sentiment, but I think if you elect people to think a bit more strategically for you, as they must on behalf of your country, that's something they can't just let go, because you've got to remember the world is watching. The world's watching. This isn't just about Ukraine. This is also about Taiwan, and it's about all sorts of other people going, let's see what we can get away with. let's see what we can do. Oh, the Russians can do this. Okay, what can we do? You know, clearly the Americans are weak. Clearly they're not able to be as strong as they've been in the past. You know, look at how they pulled out of Afghanistan, right? Embarrassing. Now Russia? What else? What else? What else can we get away with?
Well, people forget. I mean, it got overshadowed by COVID, but Hong Kong, right before the world went into lockdown in 2020, that was taken pretty easily.
Well, that's kind of the British, you know, I mean, look, Hong Kong is a difficult one for me because on the one hand, I have many friends from Hong Kong and I completely understand that people in Hong Kong have got used to a different life and you know, they think about the world the way we do. They're pro-liberty, pro-individual rights, pro all of that sort of stuff. And I, you know, I completely get that. On the other hand, if you look at the history of that place, I mean, it is in China, taken from them by force by the British at the barrel of a gun or whatever the term is. So the British had to give it back at some point. And when they did, this was always going to happen. So the best I think we could have done is get people out who didn't want to be there, which, you know, we've taken a lot of people in Britain as refugees from Hong Kong.
What was it, 100-year lease or something like that?
Yeah, it was. And it wasn't given freely. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like the Chinese suddenly went, hey, let's find some people on the other side of the world who we can give a piece of our land to.
Yeah. That's all.
It's very messy, man. History,
it's very complex.
History is a messy thing. Yeah. It's not like good guys, bad guys. It is more complicated than that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why, and again, putting in the context of like not trusting the political leaders and just being completely jaded from being a 31-year-old who grew up and saw all the bullshit from my government particularly. That's why I like Bitcoin and focusing my energy on that, because instead of screaming and trying to get involved in something very complex that I may not understand Bitcoin and do think it's an actionable solution to the problems that exist in the monetary world specifically. And I think if you fix the problems there, it can begin having positive ripple effects in other parts of life.
Oh, 100%, man. I mean, I'm not saying specifically about Bitcoin, but if we addressed a lot of the economic problems we're having, it would change the culture. I mean, a very obvious example of this is if housing is expensive, or as it is in Britain, extortionately priced, and young people can't buy a house or a flat, an apartment, you call it, and they can't pair up and they can't have kids, they are not going to be rooted in reality to a large extent. They're going to be living 7 to a flat share on their phones, and they're not going to do the things that you do in life to become grounded to the real world, like being in a relationship, having kids, or, you know, feeling like you have a stake in your society, right? That's what home ownership does to a large number of people. This is like an asset. You're going to pay it off, and, you know, 25 years from now, if you behave yourself and you do things right, you're going to have a thing that's worth, you know, $1 million or $500,000 or $300,000 or $100,000, whatever, right? And that's a very grounding thing. But if you have a problem like we do in the UK, where you've got a housing crisis and young people can't get on the property ladder at all, and they're caught in a rent trap where they're paying masses of amounts of rent so they can never save up enough to buy their own home, then you're going to create a generation of people who don't have any investment in their own society. And if you don't have investment in your society, why would you act in a constructive way? Why wouldn't you run rampant and riot and destroy and burn things and whatever? So economics matters, man. I agree with you.
Yeah, you turn to nihilism if you don't have the prospects of a better future. I mean, we see that here. Yeah. In the United States, there's some crazy stat. I think it's like 25% of millennials in their 20s still live with their parents. And then you have this dating culture. I mean, you mentioned like Gen Z is definitely beginning to rebel against that culture. But I know I feel lucky to have been married for 6 years now with a couple of kids. But I know there's a lot of people my age that are still stuck in that dating market and getting these apps, just swiping left and just dating for the fun of it, and looking at it from an outsider looking at it, it's like very nihilistic. Does not seem like
it's a very shallow and transactional world, isn't it? Like,
yes.
You know, for the fun of it, fun is fun. and that's all that it is, but it's not fulfilling.
No.
You know, and so you could argue that your single friends who are going and doing that, they're having a lot of fun and maybe more fun than you, but they're not going to be as fulfilled. No. By that process. And I'm not saying that as a theoretical, you know, someone's been married for 20 years. I got married at 20, but I just have friends who do that. And I look around at them and the truth is that almost all of them would like to move to a permanent, loving, long-term relationship in which they can experience the full joys of that. But they don't. And part of the reason is economic, part is cultural, part is, you know, people are increasingly unwilling to commit themselves to things. So the culture is very important as well.
Agreed. No, like you said, you're 40, but you're still full young. I think that's another thing people don't really realize is like it goes by very quick. I can't believe I'm in my 30s, but like the older you get, the faster it seems to go in one day.
Or a lot of it goes quick when you have kids as you and I do. Because like my son is 10 months old. I mean, he feels to me like he was born about 3 days ago, you know.
Yeah.
But it's been nearly a year.
No, my oldest is 3 now, and he's beginning to ask like complex questions, and he's very
tall.
What
is Bitcoin?
Yeah. It's the money of the future, son. You're not going to have a piggy bank.
See, that is ideology, like I said.
Is it? Is it though?
Yeah.
Why is that?
No, it could be. No, you're right. It could be just a factual statement about the future. The future currency could be Bitcoin.
I think it's going to be. Maybe that is ideological. I do have fix the money, fix the world in neon lights right outside.
Well, that doesn't have to be Bitcoin, and that I agree with, by the way.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to take too much time. I know it's getting late where you are. I really appreciate you hopping on and talk about all this stuff, because I do think, again, the framework you're trying to put out there from which to approach these varying subjects and not get stuck in a binary mindset is very important. I think it's very constructive to actually finding solutions and helping people take a step back and not scream at things and actually try to get things done.
I appreciate that, man. And you know, one olive branch I'll extend, given that I've been, mocking Bitcoin this whole interview, is, it's funny that I actually, whenever I talk to people who are into Bitcoin, they are really into this mindset. That's what I found for sure. Like, they have a constructive mindset. That's one thing I've definitely noticed. That it's a clear correlation to me from the people I speak to. Like, the people who are really into Bitcoin, they're really into, like, how do we get the future that we want? As opposed to, oh, the world's shit and we must cry about it. You know what I mean? Like, I definitely notice that for sure.
Yeah, no, it's cool. Next time you come to Austin, you got to stop by the studio.
Absolutely, man.
A lot of cool intersections between the Bitcoin world and things like regenerative farming and different ways of schooling. There's a lot of a lot of sub verticals popping out as well to really bring home like solutions that people want. Like
awesome, man.
Schooling, if you don't want your kid to get indoctrinated and sexualized at a young age, just go create a different school. There's a lot of people taking action there as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. Love it.
All right. Well, appreciate you coming on. Where can people find your book, more about you, your Substack?
So a book is An Immigrant's Love Letter to the West. My YouTube show is called Trigonometry, as in gun trigger. The people from Texas will know what I'm talking about. my Substack is just search Konstantin Kissin Substack. I'm on Twitter and all social media at Konstantin Kissin.
Awesome. Well, I hope you enjoy the rest of your night. Thank you for the conversation. And next time you come to Texas, let me know.
Appreciate it, my brother. Will do. Take care. Have yourselves a great day.
All right. Peace and love, freaks. Take care.